Welcome to Linguistics After Dark. I'm Sarah.
I'm Jenny.
And I'm Eli. If you've got a question about language and you want experts to answer it without having done any research whatsoever, we're your podcast.
Settle in, grab a snack or a drink, and enjoy.
Welcome back, friends.
Yeah!
It's been, what, like, I don't know, a couple months?
I know that a couple is not a strictly defined unit of measurement, but please
Are you saying several? A few? Are we using the pockle here?
Many.
That's probably true. It's been 3 years. Hello. We're back. We've got the gang back together. So much life has happened.
How many times have we actually collectively moved house since our last recording? It's got to be at least three, right?
I think so. I think maybe each one of us has moved at least once. Since we've done a pre-recorded episode and not a live episode,
yeah.
I have moved two times, including across the country. I now live in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I think I was still living in my old apartment for our last pre-recorded one, and now we bought a house, which is exciting.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I got married.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. I don't remember if I've moved once or twice. I might not have been living in this state, just staying with my family over school break. So I might have technically moved twice.
So collectively, since the last time that we recorded an episode, which I think in listener time will have gone out like 3 weeks ago, we have moved five times. Time is fake, y'all. It's so fake.
It's so fake. Also, there was like a pandemic in there.
That's
yeah,
it.
I know.
Although we recorded a few times during that, and then real life kept happening.
Yes. We had a convention, and we had a live show at that convention, which was a lot of fun. We're not going to talk about it. It's up on the YouTube channel. I think we've put it out on the feed at this point.
Yep, it should be everywhere.
There's some fun stuff that happened. Go listen to that
Yep.
live show.
Yep.
What are we drinking today?
That's what I was going to ask. I'm drinking a sad cocktail of Down East Cider's White Slushy. Because they did a collaboration with the actual slushy company.
And Sarah, this is the most basic thing I've ever heard you say.
No, but listen, it's going to get worse. See, the thing is that I have an incurable need to try every weird flavor variant of things. And my friend wanted cider, and so we went and bought a mixed pack of cider flavors. And then I saw, this was like the beginning of summer, they had these slushy things, and I was like, I want to try those. And the red and the blue ones are actually pretty good. The white one doesn't have enough lemon in it. It mostly just tastes like straight vodka, and by that I mean hand sanitizer.
Ooh.
Which is pretty easily solved with a little bit of lemon juice, but also my husband...
You shouldn't have to doctor your canned drinks.
You shouldn't have to doctor your canned drinks. But also my husband bought a really cool-looking bottle of lemon wine last Ooh. Week, and then we tried it, and it was, like, aggressively lemon and not in a pleasant way. So my hope is that by putting a little bit of that in my cup and then pouring in the slushy, it will actually taste good. I'll let you know.
What is lemon wine? Presumably it's not fermented lemon juice.
I think it was white wine with lemon in it.
Got it.
And
okay.
It almost worked.
Yeah, I could see that.
Anyway. Thanks. Eli, what are you drinking?
So I am drinking an iced chai. Sanya and I went on vacation earlier this summer, and we visited our friends Riker and Amy, and they had a really fantastic brand of chai concentrate called Bhakti, hashtag not sponsored, and we really loved it. So we ordered a case, and we're now through five of the six boxes that we have. So today is iced chai. So speaking of trying every flavor of something, opinions on Cellray?
Cellray is mind-boggling because there are some things that I just don't expect the flavor to be able to be recreated. And
yeah, but it's unmistakably celery.
It is. It is celery as a drink, as a soda. And for that, I love it. I think it is amazing. I also personally would not go out of my way to consume it.
I think that's fair. For me, second best flavor of Doc Brown's.
Okay, what's the first best?
The first best is black cherry, but that's because every year for Passover, I get a kosher for Passover version of the black cherry. And that's my, like, you know, I don't drink a lot of soda, but that's my treat for Passover.
We always get kosher Coke for Passover. And I also really like the Doc cream soda myself.
Doc cream soda is good. Not a big cream soda guy, but...
That's fair.
Yeah. But I'll pick up a Celray if it's, you know, if I'm in a deli or something and it's there.
All right. Also, the lemon wine white slushy bullshit was actually quite palatable.
Quite palatable is damning with faint praise.
Considering the fact that both of them were undrinkable to start with, I'll take it.
Hey, why don't we learn a language thing?
Yeah.
What is today's show brought to us by?
Today's show is brought to us by transitivity, which actually I thought this is where you were going to go with trying every flavor of thing, because in the outline I have listed every flavor of verb. Sort of.
Sweet verbs, bitter verbs, umami verbs.
Umami. Yeah, so different languages handle verbs in a variety of ways, and that pertains both to the verbs themselves and to the overall structure of the sentence. English, and I think a lot of the European languages, are structured around this idea of transitivity, meaning the extent to which a verb can affect another noun somewhere in the sentence.
Wait, hold on. Transitivity isn't universal? I thought transitivity was like a universal property of verbs.
Well, if I remember correctly from the time when I was actively studying linguistics, there are some languages that are primarily transitive versus intransitive, and there are some languages that are primarily ergative versus the opposite of that.
Accusative.
Yeah, thank you. Ergative versus accusative. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a way to interpret any language through either of those two lenses, but there's definitely, like, some languages... general basic sentence structure favors one or the other.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So the property exists in every language, or the various properties exist in every language, but it may be more or less relevant to how you're putting your sentence together.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, tell us about how it works in English.
So the word transitive means the ability to go across. And so it was named that because you're thinking about the action of the verb and whether it can go across, whether it can affect something besides the doer of the verb, the subject of the verb. And so you can kind of think of a spectrum starting at the linking verb or the copula. So those are verbs like be, is, was, am, are, all of those. And verbs like seem or appear sometimes, where you're going to have a subject, so I can say, like, my drink is cold. And my drink is the subject, and then is the verb, and then cold isn't a new thing. It's just a description of the subject. Or, you know, my cat seems sleepy.
Yeah, there's like an assignment or an equal sign, yes, rather than a relationship.
Yes, there's not an effect happening, it's just a statement of equality, yeah. So that's like a zero, that's almost not even on the scale. Then you have intransitive, so things that don't affect other things. So there is an action, but it's not affecting anything else. So sleep, right? I sleep. My cat sleeps. I want to sleep, even, but you can't sleep a nap. You can't sleep a sandwich.
In the immortal words of one of my syntax professors, you can't live a dangerous banana.
Oh my god, Dangerous Banana would be such a good band name.
Yes, I agree.
So, that's true. You make the point that in English and in a lot of languages, you can sometimes get these intransitive verbs to behave transitively, if and only if you use what's called the cognate noun. So you can sleep the sleep of the dead. You can live a dangerous life.
You can dream a sweet dream.
You can dream a sweet dream, right. But you cannot live a dangerous banana. You cannot sleep the banana of the dead. You cannot dream a sweet banana. We're going to move right on from that.
I mean, you can't even dream a scary nightmare. You can only dream a scary dream.
You can dream a scary dream. You can have a scary nightmare, but you cannot dream a nightmare. The only thing you can dream is a dream.
Yeah, you can't live a long lifetime. You can only live a long life. It's not a meaning-based thing. It's like cognate really does mean like it has to be the same word just in noun form.
Yeah. So that's the linking verbs, which are just an equal sign. The intransitive verbs, which cannot affect anything else. They can sometimes add in an almost null, empty noun just to sound nice, as long as it's the same word as it already was. Then we have transitive verbs, which do take an object. They affect something else. And a great example of that would be to chase. So I can chase my brother. A dog can chase their tail. I can chase a dream, even. I can chase something. But it doesn't really work to just be like, ah, yeah, yesterday I was chasing.
It's important to point out that there are some modifications that you can make that sort of are slang or jargon, but we're sort of sticking to kind of mainline meanings here.
Yeah, definitely. And this is also a really good place to point out that English especially has a lot of verbs that can be both transitive and intransitive, depending on how you use them. So I can say that a ballerina spins. And probably the image that comes up in your mind is a person going in circles. But I could also say the ballerina spins a top, or spins a dreidel, or spins a coin. And then presumably that person is stationary, and they have a little object in front of them that is spinning. And English is super, super flexible. In fact, it took me a long time to think of the word chase as a strictly transitive verb, because so many of our verbs in English could be transitive or intransitive. And a lot of the time, those intransitive meanings, like the ballerina spinning themselves, it really does have like this implied reflexive nature, where in other languages, in French, in Spanish, you probably would say they spin themselves. Eli, do you know how to say spin in Spanish?
No, I don't.
I have a guess, but I'm quite afraid that if I give this as an example, it will turn out to mean something else horrendous. So I'm gonna not.
But it is true that English is very, very free to kind of do this. It's called the middle. Is it a middle voice?
Middle voice or reflexive verbs. Some languages handle it with so Spanish and French handle it with an actual pronoun. So in both of those languages, you wouldn't say in English, you can say, oh, I bathe, and I could bathe my infant, or I could just bathe, and the implication is I bathe myself. And in French and Spanish, you have to say, I bathe myself. You have to put that me or that se in there to get yourself into the sentence. In other languages, for instance, ancient Greek, they don't use that reflexive pronoun, but they have a different version of the verb that means to do it to yourself. And so in Greek, you can remind someone in the active voice, and then you can remind in the middle voice, and that means to remember.
Yeah, Japanese has the same thing, and it's really hell to learn, actually, because you get these pairs of verbs where one of them is transitive and one of them is intransitive, and they usually differ by a single vowel. It's weird. It's almost like ablaut in Japanese. It is not. It is not actually ablaut in Japanese, but it is this sort of vowel grading thing that you get these similarities between transitive and intransitive, and it's not systematic. It's lexical.
Yeah, there's a couple pairs of those in Latin that I have to teach students every year. So there's the verb to hide something, and then there's the verb to lie in wait or to lie in hiding. And then there's the verb to burn, as in, like, a candle is burning, to be on fire. And then the verb, like, to burn something, to set something on fire. And it turns out that, like, 911, help, someone is burning, is like...
That's a very different call than my house is burning.
Right, like, are we sending an ambulance or a fire truck? And is this a criminal or a medical emergency? Like...
Can we have a quick sidebar about the vocabulary that comes up in Latin classes versus in sort of all other foreign languages that you might? I feel like it's both more interesting and also it's always a little more ominous.
Yeah, I think the fire bit came up because Oh god, I don't even remember. Somebody was hiding in a warehouse, and then they knocked over a candle, and then it caught fire.
Yeah, like you do.
Well, like you do.
Cool, so we got, like, intransitive verbs and transitive verbs.
Yep.
That's it, right?
Not quite. So, then we have, in English and other languages, we have what's called ditransitive verbs. So, these are the verbs that can have more than one object.
Di as in two, not di as in first year Latin vocabulary.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're right back in the Latin books.
Yes, di as in two, not as in first year Latin vocabulary. That's correct. So if you give someone something, if I give a mouse a cookie, right? I'm the subject, the mouse is one object, the cookie is the second object. And different languages handle that in different ways. Latin, for instance, always is going to use just a noun for that second object. You're always going to say, give the mouse a cookie. English, you can say, I gave a mouse a cookie, or you can say, I gave a cookie to the mouse, and you can make one of those arguments into a prepositional phrase.
Which then kind of means it's not really an argument anymore.
Kind of means it's not really an argument anymore, but also semantically, I still can't be like, oh yeah, I gave a cookie. So syntactically it's different, but semantically it still has to be there.
Yeah. There is a whole thing in here about like case marking with ditransitive verbs and also just with different transitivity. But also, like, case marking is not the end-all and be-all. There's, like, an overlapping system here of sort of roles with relation to the verb and case markings, but they're not one-to-one.
Yes.
But that is ergativity, which we are not talking about right now.
Correct. However, it's also passivity, which I do want to touch on just for a moment. In a moment, though. Because there were two other things I was going to add. And I was going to get distracted.
Excellent foreshadowing.
Yeah. One of my college professors made an argument for English's singular tritransitive verb.
Okay. I haven't heard of this. And I have heard some weird syntax shit about transitivity and other stuff, which we'll get into when we talk about passive and causative. But what is English's tritransitive verb?
So his argument was the verb to bet. Because you bet, so I am one argument, I'm the subject rather, I bet Eli, one argument, $5, two arguments, that we could finish this podcast in under 4 hours.
Yeah, I'll take that bet.
What about under 2 hours?
I will not take that bet.
And so that we could finish this podcast is not a noun, the way that the other things are, but it is a...
I mean, it's a CP.
What does C stand for again?
And, I mean, the whole point of XBAR is that it doesn't actually stand for anything, but I think coordinator...
Yeah. It's a phrase that acts like a noun, essentially. And so he was like, if you look at it that way, it's tri-transitive. He's like, but that's not, like, a real thing that people agree on. That's just his hot take.
Oh, man. I'm like, okay, I'm having a moment, though. I think I need a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I... Oh, man. There's a paper somewhere about this, I'm sure.
I'm sure there is. I'll see if I can dig it up for the show notes. But the other thing that I came across, actually just in preparing this thing of the day, was the idea of a complex transitive, which, again, I have never heard of before, like, half an hour ago. But this is sort of when you take a transitive verb and a linking verb and smush them up together. So I could say that my cat seems sleepy, or, you know, my cat seems to be a bully. But then I could make myself the subject of the sentence, and I could say, I consider my cat to be a bully. So it's like, I consider my cat, that's just a straight up transitive verb, but I consider them something.
I mean, that seems ditransitive to me, though.
Yeah.
I mean, especially if you're sort of, you're going to say one of these arguments is a CP, like,
yeah,
I consider something, and then you have a phrase that's the other argument.
Yeah, that maybe it is just a ditransitive. I was not totally clear on what the difference was, so feel free, listeners, to look up more about that.
Yeah, and I think it should be said that there's lots of stuff to think about in linguistics, but if you are getting into syntax and you're getting into sort of utterance level and that kind of thing, like, verbs are where a lot of the action is, and there are a lot of different models about how verbs work. You've got all kinds of sort of theories that try to fit different kinds of evidence from different languages in. And so there's a lot here about there isn't one grand unified theory of verbs and how they work. There's sort of a lot of things that cover, just like in the rest of linguistics, a lot of things that cover like 90% of what's going on. And there's a lot of times where people have looked at a phenomenon and given it a different name than somebody else who's looked at a phenomenon.
That's true.
So I think like this makes sense. And you know, get these conversations like Sarah and I are having, where is that complexly transitive? Is this some kind of construction that is different? Or is this, you know, a sort of something that is more normally attested and it's not anything special? The causative has some interesting properties and has been used in a lot of, well, the causative and the passive have been used in a bunch of different linguistic theories to model a bunch of stuff. I took a seminar when I was in undergrad where my professor was building an argument of sort of verbs having an inner structure in terms of things like the verb kill having an inner structure that was cause to die, and that there are a bunch of verbs that sort of are intrinsically causative forms of another verb. And I think in English, that doesn't make a lot of sense because those are clearly sort of two distinct verbs and they have different etymologies and that kind of thing. But in languages where they are much more closely related, where the sort of transitive, intransitive forms of the verb are much more closely related, it is a theory that at least has some legs. I have to say personally, I don't buy it, but I see where it's coming from and I wouldn't be surprised if it, you know, I don't buy it universally, I think is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So then the last thing that I wanted to say was about the passive voice and the case marking and all of that.
I am ready to be told about the passive by you.
Well played. So all of the examples I've given so far have been active, either that someone is something or someone does something, possibly to other people or things. And the passive is when someone experiences something. Something is done to somebody. So Eli will be told about the passive voice by me. And in English, we do that by taking one of the arguments from a transitive verb and turning it into the subject. And then the subject, who had been the doer of the action, the agent, can be added in after the fact with a by phrase, if we want to. So I could say, Eli will be told about the passive voice by me, or I can just say, Eli will be told about the passive voice, and leave it there. One of the really cool things about English is that we have so many ditransitive verbs that can be made passive with either of the two objects as the subject. So I could say, coffee is given to Eli by Sarah. Or I could say, Eli is given coffee by Sarah. And those are both
fine. And
that,
by the way, is how we know that that's ditransitive.
Yes.
I mean, it's a test for that.
Yes.
Because those two arguments should be, or I guess the second and third argument, it's the subject, it's technically an argument, but the second and third argument are equal status in this passive construction.
Yep. Now, in Latin, which is always my point of comparison because that's my day job, you cannot do
that.
You
and the entire 19th century.
I know. Even if you would consider some of these verbs to be ditransitive, and I have never actually done a Latin syntax study, so who knows what they would actually say, you cannot take those two arguments of equal weight and make either one of them into the subject. It has to be the accusative. It has to be the direct object. So if I was taking the sentence, Sarah gave coffee to Eli, and I wanted to make it passive, coffee has to be the subject. If I say, Eli was given, no matter what the rest of the sentence says in Latin, that would mean that I picked Eli up and gave him to somebody. And one of the kind of iconic Latin verbs that we have a lot of trouble with is to win. Because in English, I can win a game. And I can say, the game was won. But the verb...
Oh, you can win a game and you could win a prize? Is that what
you can
going?
Win a prize? Yeah, you can win a game and you can win a prize. And you can just win intransitively. And the verb that we often use in Latin for this is winco. And intransitively, we translate it as win a lot. but transitively, Winko means to defeat. And so when we see it in the passive, students often want to translate it as, like, the game was won, or the Romans were won. And I'm like, okay, but if you say in English, the Romans were won, that doesn't...
Yeah, that has unfortunate implications.
That doesn't mean that they lost. That means that the claw in the grab machine came down and picked them up.
Okay, that's a much less unfortunate implication than I was alluding to.
Or that they were prisoners of war, or, you know, all kinds of things. But it doesn't imply that they were ever one of the combatants. It implies that they were strictly the prize. And if that's the story you're telling, then that's fine. But that's not the story that that Latin verb is telling. And so we use win so often, and then when we get to the passive, I'm like, all right, you need to set that definition aside and pick one in English that has the right type of transitivity.
Pick one in English, O-N-E.
Yes.
So in my head, I always think of this as, like, the verb having slots.
Yes.
You know, there's sort of, like, one slot before for the subject and another slot after for the object, if it has it, and then, you know, if it's ditransitive, there's a third slot.
Yep.
And I always kind of think about the passive as, like, taking the nouns or the arguments as, like, marbles and, like, moving everybody over to the left one.
Yeah.
Which then, you know, if it's a transitive verb going passive, the subject marble, like, has nowhere to go. And, yeah, you can tack it on with an oblique at the end, but, like, that's, you're doing that of your own free will. You're not obligated to do it. You're only obligated to do that thing.
Yeah, I really like that image. I like that analogy. So, what about going the other way? Is there a way to move all of the marbles one thing to the right?
There is, actually, and that's the causative. So if you... Well, it depends. In English, I think this doesn't quite work because I think we have to use the verb make for causative. Like, I made Sarah sleep. Or that's a weird example.
Oh, wait, no. I have a great example. So we were talking off mic earlier about how hockey commentators especially believe that every verb is a transitive verb if you try hard and believe in yourself. And my beloved Jack Edwards of Nesson and Bruins commentary frequently will say that someone skitters the puck up the ice.
Yeah, and actually this is ripe for nonce forms. There's a lot of people who will take an intransitive verb and make it causative and do a construction like that. And it's totally reasonable. So that's one way that you can add another argument to a verb. So you can kind of go one way or another. You can even do it more than once. So if you have a ditransitive verb, of which give is one of the very few, right? You know, like, if you give a mouse a cookie, you know, I gave a mouse a cookie, and you could say a mouse was given a cookie, and then you could say a cookie was given. You can shift them in any direction.
Yes, and that's interesting because with the ditransitive one, you can either say a mouse was given a cookie or a cookie was given to a mouse, and those are both fine. But once you go down one more level, it has to be the thing that was actually moved. Like, if I say a cookie was given, that means one person picked up a cookie and gave it to somebody else. And if I say a mouse was given, that does not mean the mouse received something.
If you can add an argument with causative, you can then passivize it again. And in English, I think this usually just sort of nets out. But in Japanese, they have a passive causative, where you could say, I was made to be hit. But you still only have the single argument in the verb, because it's made transitive by the causative, and then it's made intransitive again by the passive. How about zero argument verbs in English, like rain and snow?
Yeah. So I said something when we were talking about the cognate forms about, like, these sort of null nouns that are just taking up space to sound nice. So if you live a life or sleep a sleep or dream a dream. And in English, we also put in some null pronouns to sound nice for things like rain, snow. There are ones that aren't weather verbs, but I can't think of them right now.
But there really aren't a lot. It's weather verbs are really the poster children for this.
Weather verbs are the big ones, yeah. I suppose some of our other ones in English are in phrasal ones, like it is necessary or it's important, where that could be a meaningful pronoun. So I could say, put your coat on, it's important, and it refers to putting on your coat. But I could also just say, it's important to check your fire alarms. It's important to check your smoke detectors. And it's just kind of there because grammatically in English, saying is important to, it's not a thing. It also doesn't work to be like, ah, yeah, is raining.
Doesn't work.
Right.
And this isn't a pro-drop thing. So there are, you know, English isn't a pro-drop language. We have to have an explicit subject 99.9% of the time. But this isn't the same thing as that. These are really verbs that wish that they had no arguments and are restricted from having no arguments because of syntax.
Right. And in languages that do allow pro-drop, those verbs are not going to have that it. They're going to take their option to have no arguments and have no arguments. And even so, like, Latin and Spanish both don't require a subject pronoun, but you can put one in if you want to clarify or to emphasize. And as far as I'm aware, no Latin or Spanish speaker would be like, ah, yeah, it is raining, because that just sort of demands, well, what is raining?
I mean, this is a thing that people ask a lot, right? And okay, it's raining, like, what's raining? And people say the sky, the world, the, you know, existence, but it's not any of those things. It's just English syntax requiring that there be a word to fill that. There has to be a marble in that slot. And so we've just picked the most neutral one that we have. This is called an expletive, by the way.
Yes. Not quite the same as the swearing expletives, but yes.
Cool. All right. So we've done zero argument, one argument, two argument, three argument, and possibly four argument verbs.
Yeah.
I think that's everything.
I think so. Y'all feel free to write in.
Do one word imperatives factor in here?
Oh, no. Okay.
Go.
Yeah, okay. Well, so that blows everything out of the water. I think that, oh man.
No, what do you mean that blows everything out of the water?
I mean, it doesn't. I think that that's a different thing. I think that that's an invisible argument. It's a clear marble, but the marble's definitely there.
Right. It's interesting because with the weather verbs, with the zero argument verbs, the implication is something / a lack of thing is raining, is necessary, is foggy, whatever.
Yeah, you kind of just want to be like, there's rain out there. Here's a noun that exists, but I need a verb in the sentence.
Right. And it's true that, like, it is important or there is a requirement. Like, those are two ways of phrasing the same thing, and it's sort of like an existential type of thing. And by we, I mean English speakers over thousands of years have identified there and it as being the, like, least meaningful marble that we could put to fill that slot. The imperatives are so interesting because the implication is not this nebulous existential thing, but it's very much you, the person I'm talking to.
Yeah, there's no doubt whatsoever as to who the imperative applies to. And so it might really be the only place in English where you don't actually need a subject because it's so strongly implied by the discourse context.
Yeah. That's a really, really good question.
Ah, man. Jenny just coming in and blowing our whole thing up here.
Perfect. A+. It's what we don't pay you for.
Thank you.
Transitivity is important. And maybe later we'll talk about ergativity, which is vastly more mind-bending.
Truly. Because that's the thing, right? You have some languages where transitivity is the main axis along which we measure verbs. And ergativity is, like, a cool, interesting thing. And then you look at a language where ergativity is the main axis, and to our brains, it's just like, what?
Yeah, it is a system that you really have to get your mind around, especially if you have really only studied Western languages and actually sort of many of the very popular languages. There's a thing that we really didn't talk about in here, which is about that there are two different kinds of intransitive verbs in English that have to do with which argument is missing if you were to turn it into a transitive verb. And we are not going to go into that.
It might be time to move on to some real language questions. submitted by real listeners.
If you want to send us a question, email it in text to questions@linguisticsafterdark.com or send us an audio recording of you speaking your question aloud. Audio is especially handy for phonology and accent questions. We have a few accent questions lined up today. There were some that we didn't choose for this episode because it was hard to know what accent in particular you were talking about. So if you have an accent question, send us an audio recording.
And I know I said this a few episodes ago, but I will say again.
You mean 3 years ago?
I do mean 3 years ago, but I was listening to them because we were editing them because they're going to go up. Anyway, please also send us your name either in audio or in IPA so that we can credit you appropriately.
All right, let's dig in. Bex asks via Slack, are accents predictable? That is, there are specific accents people have based on the languages they've learned, and often these have specific enough features to have stereotypes. But would a native speaker of Parisian French have the stereotypical French accent when speaking English, even if they had grown up in a cultural vacuum or learned English from a book? Further, if this is predictable like this, is it sufficient to predict the accent of a native speaker of Quenya or Lochban might have when they were learning English for the first time?
That is such a fascinating question. Also, I must admit my ignorance. What is Lochban from?
So Lochban is a conlang. It is one of the earliest modern conlangs that was like, language is very messy, let's make everything logical. I think the lodge in Lochban is actually supposed to be logic, and I would expect the bon has something to do with language or tongue or something like that. It is one of these things where people said, like, oh, if we only just made language super logical and then everyone could learn the same language and then world peace.
Esperanto, but not Esperanto.
Yeah, with no, like, Esperanto, but with no, like, deep European roots.
Cool.
This is a great question, and it reminds me of one of the job prospects that they taught us about when we were in undergrad. They were like, you could go do this, which was to go work at the CIA and train spies.
Oh, yeah.
Because if your cover is that you are a tourist from Germany and you're spying in France, there are mistakes that you'll make in French as a native English speaker, and there are mistakes that a native German speaker would make in French. And you want to learn to not make the English mistakes and to make the German mistakes.
Yeah.
And being a morphosyntactician, I'd always thought of it as a syntax thing, but there's definitely a phonology aspect to it.
Absolutely. So the basic answer to all of this is, well, I don't quite understand what Bex means by a cultural vacuum, because if a native Parisian speaker learned French, even in a vacuum, they would still know French.
Yeah, I think that they're kind of talking about, like, oh, the stereotypical French accent, which is probably done by the United States hegemony of media, you know?
Well, okay, sure, it is, but also having met some native French people, that's real.
Like, I mean, yes, absolutely. But I think that's the question. Is that happening because that is how a French speaker perceives how they are supposed to speak English?
I don't think that is happening because someone has learned that this is how French speakers sound in English.
Yeah, I agree.
I think for the most part, most people are working as hard as possible to have no accent, or to have an accent that is one of the native sounding ones.
Yeah, usually to match the accent of whatever their teacher has.
Right, right.
Which is quite funny because you can tell people who learned English closer to Australia,
yeah.
People who learn English in Europe because their teachers are often Brits, and yep. People who learned English in the Americas.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, I think if they had learned English from a book, or they had never heard even if they had, like, experienced how French, quote-unquote, sounds in English, or rather how French speakers speak English, I think that accent would happen in the same way anyway. And I do think if there were enough evidence, like if I knew enough about Quenya that I could predict what types of mistakes a native Quenya speaker would make in English.
Absolutely. I mean, so it comes down to phonemic inventory, right?
Yep.
So every language has a set of phonemes that it has chosen. These are my phonemes that we are going to use. And those are not, there are overlaps, but there's a Venn diagram from language to language. I think one of the most notorious ones is English has theta and f, which are th and th, the voiced, unvoiced pair.
And that sound is why you get the French accent with the Z.
Well, but also you get that in a lot of people who are trying to learn English, because theta and f are actually two of the rarest sounds across the world. There are not a lot of languages that actually use those phonemes. And it just so happens that one of the modern linguae franca, I don't know, uses these two rare sounds. And so every language that doesn't have them has to figure out, am I using a T and a D? Am I using an S and a Z? Like, am I doing something else? Although I think TD and SZ are two of the most common substitutions. And you can actually hear that in some dialects of English that don't have that sound and instead substitute a T and a D.
Yes, you know, actually the other ones, dare. That ting dare, but also F and V. I feel like I was going to make this joke at some point during the 2022 convention, and I don't know that it actually happened, so I'm going to do it now. So a couple years ago, I was listening to an audiobook of Redwall, which is a children's story that takes place in Britain somewhere, and all of the characters are animals. And one of the characters' name is spelled, like it is a portmanteau of the word cheese, like rats and mice like to eat, and a thief, like a robber. But in that character's dialect, they did not pronounce the TH at the beginning of thief. They pronounced it like a T, and so the narrator kept calling him Cheese Thief, and I misinterpreted Cheese Thief as not a T for the TH, but an F for the TH at the end, and so I was like, oh, Cheese Teeth.
Was the character like a rat or a mouse or something?
I think so, yeah.
A rat.
Yeah, well, that makes total sense either way.
Right, so I was like, oh yeah, Cheese Teeth. And then I wrote his, I think I wrote his name in writing, because I've been listening to this audiobook the whole time, right? So I texted Jenny, who had told me to listen to this, and I referenced Cheese Teeth. And she just lost it, because she was like, no, 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 that's not his name.
I completely forgot that happened.
It was so funny. And anyway, so yes, I think you're right that TD and SZ are the most common
alternatives. Right. FV also.
But FV is totally up there. And it's not just non-native speakers. It is some native dialects that have just made that shift. And so French has, like most French speakers, when they try to replicate the TH sounds, they come up with S and Z. Whereas most German speakers, I think, come up with T and D. And so, yeah, if you're trying to, if your cover is that you're German, but you say, these are the things that I want, like, that's not believable.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, the other part of this is that those substitutions are usually systematic. So, I mean, it's dependent on dialect and it's dependent on, you know, a bunch of other stuff, but they are systematic enough that, yeah, you could do this prediction. I think a way that you can see that here is in Japanese, where if you gave me an English word, I can tell you how a Japanese speaker would try to say that word.
Sure.
And it's systematic enough that I could be quite confident. And, you know, there's always a little bit of shift. There's always a little bit at the edges. But I think that, you know, maybe we wouldn't be able to do it 100% because, say, Quenya has both SZ and TD. And so maybe we wouldn't be able to, we'd have to make an assumption about which one they would pick, but we would absolutely be able to say, here's where there is no overlap in the phonemic inventory, and so something would have to go in there. We've been talking about consonants, but this happens all the time in vowels, because English is vowels Georg and has 100,000 vowels, all of which are fake anyway, and a lot of other much better behaved languages have like five or eight or three or some sort of, you know,
manageable number.
Exactly. And so you have to have all five of those vowels work for all, you know, probably 20 vowels in English. And so they get mapped onto all of these vowels.
Yeah. Or, yeah, they get mapped on in weird ways, or they get pronounced as more syllables than the English word actually has, so that they can try to account.
Get each of the diphthong vowels or something like that.
Yeah. One of the things that I've said to my students very often is when I coach them on their pronunciation of Latin, and inevitably there's a kid every year who says, who are we even going to talk to? Like, my accent doesn't matter. And that's true. You're absolutely correct. And you're going to talk to me. We are going to be in this room for the next 9 months, and we have to agree that when I say a word out loud and say, find on the page where it says quai, that you are actually finding the same word I'm asking you to look for. Or that when you say to me, Magister, what does cella mean? That we know whether the word you're starting with starts with an S or a C, because those are different words. And so even if the accent, like, yeah, if I'm coaching you into an accent, and even if that isn't precisely what an ancient Roman would have sounded like, we have to agree on what the American English accent of Latin is, so that we can communicate.
So you once invited me to a kirtamen.
Yes.
Over Discord, which yes. was an interesting experience. But one of the things that I learned happens at a kirtamen is that the host or the question reader, kirtamen, by the way, is just quiz bowl, but for people who are so nerdy, it's going to be in Latin.
More or less.
The question reader starts every round off by reading a specific sentence so that everyone in the room knows what accent they are trying yes. to listen to.
Yes.
And I understand that some of it is for consonants, but a lot of it is for vowel pronunciation.
Absolutely. And in fact, they edited that passage a few years ago. I don't know if this was before or after you came.
I think it had happened right before, because it was like big news and everybody was adjusting to the new passage.
And all they did, they added one word, but the original passage had like every phoneme, except it didn't have any words that started with the letter H. And at different periods in Roman history, H would have been pronounced or not pronounced at the start of words, which you can tell because in different authors, those words are spelled with or without an H. And a lot of Latin teachers, frankly, will pronounce the H at the start of every word, except sometimes they will leave it off on words that have that same silent H in English. So like honor, H-O-N-O-R. For I had to actively coach myself into pronouncing it honor in Latin, because I always just wanted to read it as honor. But like, that's inconsistent with the way that I pronounce every other word that starts with H. So I like taught myself to do that. And so for ages, at the end of every passage, some kid would raise their hand and be like, do you pronounce initial H's? And then the person would say yes or no. And after a while, they just added the word for this is hic, H-I-C. And so in one of the sentences, they just added in the word this, kind of unnecessarily, just so that it would be there.
This is some Council of Nicaea shit happening.
Yes.
This is actually, it's interesting, this can be diachronic also.
Yes.
So this is reminding me, I mean, you just gave that example of the H being pronounced or not pronounced across centuries of Latin. I'm thinking about reading Canterbury Tales, and even back to like Beowulf, but you just have to go back to Middle English, which is pretty understandable for a modern reader, especially if you have seen it written down, and then you will try to read it or listen to somebody say it, and you'll say, oh, the vowel inventory is actually a lot smaller. Oh, there are differences in which way they're pronouncing things. Oh, that's not being pronounced as diphthong, it's being pronounced as two separate vowels.
Another fun side note, Quenya actually sort of has TH, but it gets replaced early on with S, and this becomes a major political drama, and whether you still use the TH or if you've adapted to using the S is actually like a signifier of your political allegiance.
I love that so much.
It's really delightful. It's like, I could get into all of the why this becomes a political drama. It has to do with someone's name, But yeah, so like, of all the like points about accents and English specifically having weird, like a weird assortment of things, you picked the one where you could actually go off into a whole thing about how actually whether or not you use TH in Quenya, it wouldn't necessarily be linked to, like, it wouldn't necessarily be about, like, how you adapt it so much as how you adapt it based on your existing political allegiance.
I mean, that tracks.
Oh, it absolutely tracks. Like, it, of course you were going to have that. And then the other fun thing is the question mentions Quenya but not Sindarin, which has both TH and the other TH, but he spells it DH, except for in, like, notes where he thinks about spelling it with straight up just an F instead, because it's Tolkien. And so he literally, there are words where it's like, the official version that you will find in the Silmarillion has this with a DH. But if you go digging around in the history of Middle-earth, or like the Parma-el-Dalaran-Varun, which we're not even getting into, because that's a whole thing, you will find words where at one point he was spelling it with an F.
I think DH is a pretty common transliteration for F also. You know, if you're trying to write some Icelandic or something.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Like, it is, it's kind of the obvious way to do it. If TH is then by extension from T to D, obviously is going to be DH. Like, that's extremely straightforward, I feel like.
Well, and adding the H for slight palatalization, or I guess alveolarization. We've talked in the past about people changing their accents for the group that they align with. All right, I don't think that we're going to get a better button on that question than bringing it all the way back to Quenya. Shall we move on to the next question?
Yeah. So in 2019, somebody asked on an index card at the very first LXAD Live, have you noticed people using the sound ts instead of t at the beginning of words? And why might that happen?
I feel like I am going to need an example of this because I am not on the TikToks. I'm officially old.
TikTok? No.
See, the funny thing is, the first person I know who pointed this out was my dad, like, years and years ago. I'm not sure it's an age thing. I think it's a regional thing, because I think he noticed it at some point after we moved to the West Coast.
Oh, well, that then double makes sense why I haven't heard this.
Do you remember an example that he gave? Because I was also going to ask for an example.
Two?
Mm-hmm.
To, like, T-O or T-W-O?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, okay, I hear that.
So it's cool that we just talked about alveolarization, because yep, that's the process that is happening here. You could also say that this is lenition, which is a more general version of this. Let's talk about fortition and lenition, which is what this question is actually about. Uncontroversial statement, over time, sounds in a language change.
Yes.
Unless you're Feanor.
And you can create a graph in the, like, network way, not in the, like, Descartes way, of which sounds tend to go to which sounds, or kind of more which sounds tend to be next to each other. And if you go one way in that graph, it's fortition, which means getting stronger. If you go another way, it's lenition, which means getting lighter. I guess fortition would be getting heavier. And so this kind of alveolarization or palatization, which is when you sort of add y to things, so to becomes t, that kind of thing, or sometimes t becomes ch, or that kind of thing, is a lenition. And so this is, I guess it's a sound change that's happening on the West Coast. Like, cool, another sound change moving its way through the Americas.
One of the places we already see a lot of sound change with word initial T is what Eli just referenced, not the TS, like S sound, but either a kind of TY or TJ, like Tia. So some people will say that music has a tune, and other people will say that music has a tune.
Or you can meet on Tuesday or Tuesday.
Yes, Tuesday or Tuesday. And for some people, then it goes even further past Tuesday all the way to Tuesday.
There's a YouTube channel that I follow called Mary Spender, And she is British and has that particular sound change. And she has, well, she had a recurring thing on her channel, which was her just talking to camera or interviewing another musician, which she called Tuesday Talks, but in her accent, it's Tuesday. And so her title card for it is Chewsday Talks.
There's a different YouTube channel that I don't know if I actually follow or if it just keeps popping up in my feed because the algorithm.
And get some thunder and lightning behind.
But it's this really sweet guy who his like day job, I guess, is as a caregiver for his elderly grandmother. And the two of them just kind of live blog their life on YouTube. And she speaks a combination of Tagalog and Spanish and English. And the days of the week she usually says in Spanish, but she will say Tuesday in English, but she only will say and will only understand it if you pronounce it Tuesday. And so they also have a whole running gag about Tuesday, C-H-E-W.
This is a channel on YouTube?
YouTube, yeah. Or actually, they might be Tuesday as in, like, selecting rather than nomming.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's also interesting to note that in all of our examples, it's T-U. So this doesn't happen at the bottom of the vowel space. It's happening at the top of the vowel space. But I think that that's because that palatalization is very related to the y glide, and the y glide is very related to vowels happening at the top of the mouth. There's also TR, which turns a lot into ch, which I think basically everybody that I know has this, even if they don't think that they do. So there are trees in the yard. There aren't trees in the yard. There are trees in the yard.
I genuinely think I go back and forth between actual trees and trees.
I think you do. I think you're the only person I know who does.
Yeah, but you see this so much in little kids first learning to spell, because little kids are so good at sounding out words, and then we grow up and we forget, and we like learn what those underlying phonemes are, and we stop thinking about what they actually are realized as. But little kids sound stuff out, and they will write you a story about a guy who drives a truck. C-H-R-U-K.
Which is how that word is said.
Which is how that word is said. It's so good.
Yeah, and then those little kids forget that, and then they grow up, and then they go to undergrad, and they go to phonology class, and then you have to learn it all over again. So you sit there in a minor existential crisis as you unlearn listening to your underlying representation and listening to your surface representation.
I just found the graphic of the little kid spelling triangle as C-H-R-I-E-G-O.
Triago!
Triago! It's perfect.
It is perfect.
It even has the little kind of like snot-nosed little kid thing happening.
Yes.
With the taking the L out.
Yeah, because L's are hard, man.
L's are hard, especially syllabic L.
Yeah.
We have a conference at work coming up where we have a whole bunch of people giving talks. And one of the things that was requested is, please tell us how to pronounce your name so that we say it correctly when we introduce you. And one of my coworkers has a name with a syllabic L in it. And they pinged me on the side and they were like, it's been a while since I've used IPA. I'm pretty sure that this is right. And I was like, yes, that does sound right. Also, this is advanced IPA. It's got a syllabic L. You've got, like, the correct vowels in there. And the hosts of this conference are not linguists. They're not going to know how to read this. And he was like, yeah, I was going back and forth between, like, do I write it out in the way that they'll look at it and understand it, or do I write it out correctly?
Both. Eli said something a minute ago about the high vowels and getting Tuesday and Tuesday, and I think, Jenny, you said the example that your dad had given was like Sue.
Talk would be another?
Talk, yeah. So to the part of the question that was, why might that happen? I am going to say it's happening because of those high vowels. Often, well, talk.
Talk is interesting because talk to me sounds like a very specific New York Jewish accent.
Talk as in like, I'm going to give a talk.
Well, I'm going to talk to you right now.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we actually do have two different things going on here. So there's the high vowel thing, which gives us potentially two, but also two, Tuesday, truck, triangle. Either the high vowel or the R thing. Because T plays interestingly with those sounds. But Eli, you're right. Like, we're going to have a talk in a kind of like New York.
It's a very Fran Drescher, the nanny kind of a thing. Come here, I want to talk to you.
Yeah, I want to talk to you. Who are you talking to? Yeah, that's not a vowel thing, but I don't know why that would be, other than a general lenition thing where moving from a stop to an affricate like ts tends to happen over time, and certain dialects may have begun that process.
Yeah, you've got an articulation type thing here. So if it's happening with all vowels, then it seems like it may just be language changing and people deciding to say that sound in a little bit of a different way.
Yeah, and the question asker did point out it's at the beginning of words, and it's not surprising that it would happen in that certain context, as it is the quote-unquote standard American pronunciation of the phoneme t at the beginning of words tends to be aspirated, and in the middle of words tends to not be aspirated, and at the end of words tends to be sometimes even clipped, let alone unaspirated, just like not even fully pronounced. And so I could see how t, with that aspirated extra air coming behind it, could...
Yeah, starts to make it more of a fricative.
Starts to make it sound a little more fricative, a little more affricate. And for some people hearing the t, their brain hears that and says, well, what's the closest sound I know how to say, and comes to ts. Or that some people t, and they just hit an S in there and they start to keep it. Another place where I've seen that particular sound change is in Latin, and over the development of the pronunciation of Latin and into Italian, and in then further into English, words that end in T-I-O-N in classical Latin would be pronounced, so if we took lenition, for example, in classical Latin that would be pronounced lenitio, or lenitiones, or whatever. It would have a very pronounced T-I-O, T-O. However, in later Latin, and in the way that Latin is pronounced now in Europe, it would be pronounced lenitio with a ts in there.
That's also in ecclesiastical Latin, which is the kind of Latin that most of the kids I knew learned growing up, because we were all a bunch of Catholics. So you still learn ecclesiastical Latin, and it has the C.
Yes. And my husband, who is not Catholic, studied for a long time with a professor from Germany who pronounced it that way. And my husband picked that up without even noticing. And now it drives a lot of his coworkers crazy because he's like, oh yeah, lenitio. And they're like, you're not German. Stop it. He's like, but I like it. No.
And then that softens even further with the English loanword.
Yes.
Lenition.
Yes. And so all of those T-I-O's started out as T-O, and then C-O, and then sh.
Yeah, you even lose the vowel in there.
Yes.
Or it changes.
Yeah. The O softens or moves from O to U, but the I changes from being a vowel to just being the glide that's in the fricative.
And again, you've got that high vowel glide situation happening.
Yep. And I do think that in Latin it tends to be predominantly in front of the high vowels, but it also is syllable initial. So you would not have a word in Latin like et that means and. I don't think at any point in the development of Latin or Italian that became pronounced as ets, because there's no vowel after it. There's not even anything after it. But lenitio, you get some of the articulation, the aspiration, the high vowel, you start to get that shift. So it's unsurprising that we see it a lot in English with high vowels, and it's really unsurprising that we see it word initial.
Yeah, or maybe syllable initial, syllable onset. But I think I think it's even stronger word initial. I think that's a really great insight to this.
Yep.
Cool. Let's move on to another question.
Yeah.
So Elijah Baragovsky asks via email, how do songs in tonal languages work? How do the speakers distinguish between the melody and the tone? I feel like this is a question that every single person who learns about tonal languages, if they're not a native speaker of one, sort of immediately asks. Because the initial comparison of tonal languages is sort of to a melody or to singing, which I would argue is not a great comparison, actually.
Yeah. I would agree that that's not a great comparison. I would also say that the answer to this, as far as I'm aware, is how do songs work with difficulty? How do they distinguish the melody and the tone? They don't.
So here's the thing. English is a tonal language, but we don't use it for distinguishing meaning between two different words. Like, we don't use it as a, you know, an aspect of a minimal pair between homophones or near homophones. We use it to indicate emphasis and subtext in our utterances.
We use it more at a sentence level than a word level.
Yes. Although we also have the, there's the verb noun alternation where you've got stress, but stress in English comes out sometimes in a tonal way where one syllable will be higher if it's got more stress, so that kind of thing. So the question then is, like, how can you tell whether something is record or record in a song in English? It's the same answer.
Yes and no. In English, at least in my experience, there's a great deal of effort put in by most songwriters and most poets to fit the native stress pattern of the words to the rhythm of what they're writing.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point.
And that there are certain places where they just can't make it work. And those stick out. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it works, but it sounds funny. And sometimes songs make it to publication with that sort of aggressively shoved in there in the wrong stress pattern thing. And I think you should have workshopped this one a little longer.
Well, and then you get made fun of for putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yes.
Ding.
Well played. On the flip side, at a sentence level, it is much more true that we tend to have different patterns of pitch and tone following an entire statement or an entire question. And so, I will go to the store today versus will I go to the store today are distinct from each other in the order of the first two words. And so, even if you don't have the pitch matching up to the tune of the song, you can fall back on the word order.
Yeah, there is a, you can in music have a call and response or a question and answer thing with the melody also, but that doesn't have to line up with the syntax of any lyrics. But I do think that this basically just comes down to context and lack of ambiguity and maybe even a particularly skilled enough songwriter using the ambiguity because you don't have that information.
Yeah.
But I would expect that it is not speakers distinguishing between melody and tone, and instead using redundancy that's built into the language to unconsciously reconstruct the information that they're missing.
Yes, I think it's a lot of using redundancy, but I also anecdotally have observed and also been told that, for instance, Chinese music videos have the lyrics on screen way more than English music videos do.
That's true.
In part because once you start singing, it can be hard, even if you do pronounce the tones, it can be hard to hear them. Sometimes it's not even possible to pronounce the tones comprehensibly and maintain the tune. And so part of it also is hearing the song, but also knowing what it means to say because you've seen it written or heard it spoken without music. And then once you put the tune to it, it doesn't sound ambiguous anymore because you know what it means to say.
That's very interesting. I never considered that that would be a reason that there are a lot of captions on television in East Asia, because that that is a thing that happens. There's a lot of captions. There's a lot of text on screen. I always thought that it was a cultural thing. I never thought that it was necessarily functional. But you kind of wonder, I mean, TV's only been around for a century or so. Singing basically has existed for all of human existence. I would love to know a comparison between, for example, classical Chinese songs and modern Chinese songs, and if there's more, if there's some mechanism that was used earlier, or if there's more ambiguity that is resolved by captions on screen.
Definitely. And, you know, just kind of speculatively, one of the things that I could say is before TV, before radio, before records, if you're singing, if you're listening to music, it's with people who you can stop and say, wait, what does that lyric mean? Or, wait, I didn't understand that. And as they teach you the song, they can say the words in a less ambiguous way. And part of the difficulty with radio and records and TV is that it's not live and interactive in the same way. And so by publishing lyrics in the record liner or by putting captions on screen, you can kind of solve that a little bit. I don't know if that's true, but I imagine that's one of the ways you might have been able to resolve some of that ambiguity before the technology that we have now.
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't do any research on this podcast, so I would love if there are any Chinese speakers out there, you know, if somebody could write in and teach us about this, is it would be very cool. You know, even just to say if we're along the right track or if we are totally speaking out of nowhere here. But I just want to emphasize, we don't do any research. This is speculation based on an informed background.
Exactly.
Dang. I thought that question was going to be really straightforward, and actually there was a ton of good depth in there. Thank you, Elijah, for that question.
All right, let's have a look at a couple puzzlers before we wrap up. So, last time, our puzzler was, think of an informal term for a beverage. Now, say it in Pig Latin, and you'll have an informal term for another beverage. What two beverages are these?
So, funny story. The last time that we recorded a puzzler was 3 years ago. So I went to our outline from 3 years ago saying, okay, cool, let's put this puzzler in the outline. And then I realized I had not written down the answer. So we started late in part because I could not remember the answer to this puzzler and we had to actually solve it. Sarah came up with a great suggestion.
This is not the answer because neither of these are beverages, I hope.
One hopes.
But a pair of words that does fit this pattern are trash and ashtray.
There is somebody out there with a folk etymology where the ashtray was because smoking was taboo. And so, you know, if you needed to put your cigarette out.
Oh my gosh.
I was just going to say, I feel like those are probably drinks at a really weird bar somewhere.
You know, the world is vast. So the answer is Joe and OJ. So okay. Joe is an informal name for coffee, and OJ is an abbreviation for orange juice. And if you said Joe in Pig Latin, it would be OJ.
Those are much better beverages than trash and ashtray.
So if that was your answer, you came up with that, good job. Probably took you not as long of a time to come up with it as it took us. Now that we've solved the last puzzler, I'm going to give you a new one. Okay, so this is, it's going to be a little North America specific, I apologize, but, you know, the information that you need is very easily available on Wikipedia. So you're going to think about the teams in the NFL, that's the National Football League. You're going to take one team and change a single letter in its name, and you're going to take their rival and change a single letter in their name. Those two words are synonyms, and they will be synonyms of a third NFL team, which happens to be in the other conference. So which teams and which words are these? Once again, you're going to take two NFL teams that are rivals, change one letter in each of their team names, and you'll get synonyms for the name of a third NFL team. Which teams are they?
So the synonyms are after the letters are changed in the first two teams.
Yes.
Okay.
We'll have that answer on the next episode of Linguistics After Dark. All right, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening.
Linguistics After Dark is produced by Emphasizing Enterprises. Audio editing is done by Luca. Question wrangling is done by Jenny. Show notes are done by lots of us, sometimes me. And transcriptions are a team effort. Our music is Covert Affair by Kevin McLeod.
Our show is entirely listener supported. You can help us by visiting patreon.com/mfozzing, E-M-F-O-Z-Z-I-N-G, and by telling your friends about us. Ratings on iTunes and other podcast services help as well.
Yeah, and it turns out that Spotify recently introduced the ability to rate podcasts. So if you're listening on Spotify, throw us a rating. That would be great. Every episode, we also love to thank our patrons and reviewers. Today, we would love to say thank you to these awesome patrons: Ralph, Callie, Oseas, Vex, and Dre. We also want to thank Lingshitz and Charlie B for reaching out to us on Instagram, and Duskamu and Jenny Sock for leaving us reviews on iTunes. Thanks so much, and if I said your name wrong, let me know.
Find all our episodes and show notes online at linguisticsafterdark.com or on all your favorite podcast directories. And I will say, our live shows have video on our YouTube channel, which is also Linguistics After Dark. And send those questions, text or audio, to questions@linguisticsafterdark.com. Or you can X them to us at LXADpodcast. Not sure how much longer we're going to be on the service formerly known as Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram, also at LXADpodcast. By the time this comes out, it's possible we'll have like a blue sky and Mastodon and all that stuff too.
Ideally, on whatever service you use, if we exist, we will be LXADpodcast. And until next time, if you weren't consciously aware of your tongue in your mouth, now you are.
Thanks, Google.
Mispronouncing a name, Civil War.
We've saved the spirit of the index cards. The noumena of the cards lives on.
The lemon wine white slushy bullshit was actually quite palatable.
Quite palatable is damning with faint praise. I'm not sure that the noumena of the index card knew that.
I don't remember enough about this. All right.
Appendices or it didn't happen. Yeah, man, if only they had gender theory in Valinor. None of this is usable.